Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Voters have been casting ballots in Georgia over the past few weeks. Along with choosing candidates, early voters like Roxy D. and Sarika Mahajan faced a list of amendments on the ballot.
I know they wanted to raise some taxes, lower some taxes, help with the conserving the clean water. But yeah, it was a lot of gibberish.
Some of them that were straightforward, I kind of understood, and then the other ones that I didn't really have a lot of knowledge about, I just kind of left them blank because I didn't truly understand what they would do, what they really meant.
They are not alone in finding some ballot measures confounding. Why is that? And which items are at stake in this midterm? GPB reporter Stephen Fowler is here to help explain these electoral mysteries. Hello, Stephen.
Good morning.
And also Zach Peskowitz. He's assistant professor of political science at Emory. Welcome, Zach.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Zach, why do so many ballot measures read, as we heard, like gibberish?
I think at some level, whenever you're talking about statutes and legal language, there's some inherent complexity. That said, I think some states are a bit more proactive in trying to express things in layperson's terms. Some states spend a lot of resources trying to educate voters in terms of sending out pamphlets, voter education guides, and others just let the legal language speak for itself.
In 2016, some people in Georgia sued over the wording of a ballot question. It was regarding the state takeover of low-performing schools. So is there a political strategy in the wording of these measures?
Yeah, I think so. Usually you see proponents of ballot measures doing internal polling, seeing how different wording plays among the electorate, and there's quite a lot of care in determining what will be successful.
Well, Ballotpedia gives a breakdown. I don't know if you use any other sources, Zach.
Ballotpedia is wonderful.
Well, it's you know, voting yes on this means blank and voting no means blank. But it doesn't tell you who the interested parties are. So, Stephen, how first do these measures get on the ballot?
So they have to get there because through the state legislature, it's not just drawn up one day, that two-thirds of both chambers have to pass it. The governor has to sign it. And then it has to be added on to the next election's ballot. So it doesn't come from nowhere, so to speak.
But legislators write them, or do citizens, you know, petition to get something on the ballot?
No, it's a legislative thing. So it has to go through Georgia's State House and State Senate.
What's the role then of lobbying groups from within and outside of Georgia on getting measures on the ballot?
Well, sometimes when you have these constitutional amendments, there some of them are people powered, where citizens say, hey, we want to do this. But you do have these lobbying groups that help a lot of laws get passed, whether it's, you know, things like the Mimosa mandate to change alcohol sales, or something on the ballot like Marcy's Law this year. So the lobbying groups kind of help craft legislation. They may suggest to lawmakers, here's what we have in other states, or here's how best this would fit Georgia. And they kind of help guide and shape, influence the elections, and influence, and not influence in like a hacking kind of way, but influences and say, hey, this would be great for Georgia to have this, and the lawmakers can sign it, or they can, you know, tell Georgians, hey, this would be great if you voted for this. We would appreciate it.
Well, that sounds very civil and very democratic, but what do we know, Zach, about the kind of outside money or money in general that is spent on efforts to get things on the ballot?
Yeah, there is a lot of evidence that television advertising, get out the vote campaigns can be consequential in determining whether one of these ballot measures pass or not. I think an interesting thing in Georgia this cycle is that you're seeing most of the money coming in on one side of these ballot measures, particularly Marcy's Law. There's about $8 million has been spent advertising for it, and there isn't any organized opposition.
Yeah, this is a huge campaign, along with the measures being voted on here in Georgia. This is Marcy's Law. Listeners may have seen Kelsey Grammer offering advice on how to vote. What exactly, Stephen, is the amendment proposing?
So this amendment is a victims' rights law is what it's being billed as. And so it would give victims of a crime or alleged victims of a crime kind of equal rights as the accused in some things. So some of it would be notification of something like, you know, if somebody steals your car and they're, you know, you would be notified when they're facing a court date and when they're having a hearing and if they're in prison, when they get out of prison. And so it's kind of billed, especially with a lot of these advertising and a lot of the money, it's being billed as this way to give equal rights to victims of crimes.
So vote yes if you want it to pass, vote no if you don't want it to pass. That seems fairly straightforward. But who are the stakeholders in this amendment passing or failing?
Well, so Georgia already has many victims' rights in state law and different things, but this would elevate it up to the constitutional level, which is obviously broader standing and bigger deals. So the people that support this are victims' rights advocates groups and people who are victims of crimes who think that this gives another opportunity for equal treatment and equal protection and being able to know when something's happening. I think one of the ads that's out, in tones that people, he murdered your sister and now he roams free. You're using these kind of intimidating sounding languages to say that if this bill passes, then you can be safe and protected. Now, some people are saying that this unnecessarily elevates victims' rights into a constitutional level and gives kind of an uneven standing when it comes to, the right for people who are accused of crimes.
Right. So they haven't been tried yet you will be warned. It's as if they've been criminally prosecuted already.
Right.
Right. So, Zach, statewide initiatives and referenda, this started around the turn of the 20th century. So what was going on then that brought about the change?
Yeah. So there were kind of three important state rules about that were created during the populist and progressive era that tried to implement direct democracy, if you will. So they're called the initiative, the referendum, and recall of elected officials. The initiative and referenda work a little bit differently. Initiative are citizen petition-led ballot measures, whereas referendum come from the legislature.
What would be an example of both of those?
So in a lot of Western states, the initiative is available, and what you'll see is a petition drive. Once a certain number of signatures have been gathered, then the initiative will just directly appear in the ballot. In contrast with the referendum, we first have to go through the legislature. So very different consequences of those two different rules.
So what kind of power does it give to us that didn't exist before the progressive era or before the turn of the century?
So particularly with the initiative, you have the option of totally circumventing the legislature. So in a lot of states, there are policies that the legislature is not interested in passing, and the initiative is another way for the voters to kind of bypass the legislature and directly get something passed into law.
That's Zach Peskowitz. He's from Emory University. We're talking with him and with GPB's reporter Stephen Fowler about some of the ballot initiatives that are on the statewide ballot. Of course, it's going to vary from county to county and place to place where you're voting. They seem to exist, however, in a different, let's say, conversational universe than the bigger political races. Like, people talk about who they're voting. They often, put out yard signs, their supporters. So what is the connection, however? Not sure which one of you wants to pick this up. How does a politician's endorsement of a ballot item affect voters?
I think it does. And going back to the original point about the complexity of language, so these ballot measures are often not directly comprehensible. So citizens look to politicians, interest groups that they support to try to get an understanding of how they should vote.
So you vote yes on question two kind of thing, right?
That's right.
Right. Stephen, also amendments that would establish a business court is up in the Georgia referenda. Who wants that to pass and who doesn't?
Well, so the business court would be beneficial to businesses. The logic behind this kind of separate court for these complex business cases is a little bit like somebody explained it to me like this. You wouldn't go to a heart doctor if you had a back problem. And so oftentimes these complex business cases are kind of different legal parameters and different legal cases than, say, a theft case or, some other sort of criminal or civil case. So this would create a separate business court with judges that have business expertise to decide on these complex business cases, and it would free up other judges from having to deal with these business cases. You know, you may have a judge that does a, say, paper ballot hearing one day that then has to go and decide these complex business matters. So, the court system would like to have business courts. And then obviously the businesses that have to be in court a lot would prefer to have a separate case to be able to have their cases heard by somebody who knows what they're talking about more so than just a general knowledge judge, so to speak.
So who's against it?
I haven't really seen much opposition to this, other than the judges on this business court would be appointed by the governor instead of elected like some other judges are.
Okay. So another amendment that could have a financial impact on businesses, let's say the brunch bill, which would expand the hours that alcohol can be sold on Sundays. What are some of the arguments for and against this?
So the brunch bill was a really popular bill during this election season.
I can imagine.
And what it allows, the brunch bill, the mimosa mandate, whatever you want to call it, it allows different municipalities, you know, cities or counties, to vote this November, tomorrow, whether or not to move Sunday alcohol sales an hour earlier. Right now, if you go to brunch, you want to get a mimosa, a Bloody Mary, it's 12:15, you can't do it. But with this, it would move it before 12:30 to, you know, 11 or 11:30, depending on where it is. So reporting on the story earlier in March, there were a lot of different groups that were in favor of this. Obviously, people who like brunch, people who like mimosas, but
and people who sell to them.
Exactly. The businesses, the Georgia Restaurant Association and other groups said that selling alcohol earlier, especially with Atlanta, with like tourist seasons and things, that, you know, the Super Bowl is coming. Imagine all of the people coming and all of the restaurants and all of the money that could be lost if, you know, somebody comes at 11 o'clock and they want to have a drink, but they have to wait until 12:30. So those are the people that are for this brunch bill.
And against?
Well, interestingly enough, some of the opposition is from the faith-based community, saying that, you know, it's already being sold on Sunday. If you want to get a drink or if you want to buy a 12-pack, you can do it later on Sunday or on Saturday. But in the process of getting this through the legislature, you know, I talked to the Senate Majority Leader, who said he personally did not support Sunday sales and people drinking on Sunday, but it wasn't his decision to decide what other counties and cities and things did. So that's about how we got to where we are.
Okay, one more I want to get through. Although there are more, again, people can go to Ballotpedia. That's one good example of to get a breakdown of these kind of amendments. A few deal with Georgia's natural resources. So bring us through the proposed Georgia Outdoor Stewardship Trust Fund. How would that work?
So, you know, speaking to the earlier conversation about advocacy groups and lobbying groups and other things pushing through, this one's taken almost a decade to get. Environmental groups say that there needs to be more money to be spent on things like parks and restoration and preservation and things like that. So this would take, you know, you go to Dick's Sporting Goods and you buy a kayak or some binoculars or some fishing poles. They would take a portion of that sales tax to create this stewardship trust fund to kind of help preserve Georgia's green spaces, help it grow. And it would be over the next 10 years. But like a good government, there's a provision in there that if the economy starts doing terribly, that that money would then go back to the general pot.
Sounds like a no-brainer. Any real opposition to that one?
None that I've really seen.
Well, both, these ballot initiatives will differ by county to county, so make sure you look up what is on tap in your district. But do you think, Zach, do voters in general study up on ballot initiatives? What could make them more interesting to the voter?
I think when there's a lot of advertising, voter interest peaks and there's more of an effort to gather information. I think that's a big component. In general, these receive less media coverage than candidate elections, particularly when you're talking about state and local ballot measures.
So, we just have 30 seconds left. Do we have any idea how many people just leave them blank?
Yeah, so it's fairly typical for 5 to 10% of voters to cast a vote on the top of the ticket elections, but not vote on these measures down at the bottom of the ballot.
Zach Peskowitz, he's Assistant Professor of Political Science at Emory. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And GPB's reporter Stephen Fowler. You'll be hearing more from this guy in the next couple of days. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a tradition that has been cutting paths through Georgia since the 1700s. Gerrymandering. That's when On Second Thought continues here on GPB. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. No matter who he or she is, Georgia's next governor will have the power to reshape the state's politics, quite literally. In 2021, state legislators will redraw their own respective districts, as well as Georgia's congressional districts based on data from the 2020 census. The next governor gets to approve or veto those new maps. Charles Bullock is author of Redistricting, the Most Political Activity in America. He's also professor of political science at the University of Georgia and joins us now from WUGA in Athens. Charles, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasant to be here, Virginia.
So based on that title, The Most Political Activity in America, why do you call it that?
Well, because it has such long-lasting impact. The stakes are so high. Districts that get drawn in 2021 will probably, with maybe some minor modifications, be in place for a decade. So you get to shape the elections not just for 2022, but for 2024, 26, 28, 30. So if the maps are particularly friendly to one of the parties, it may guarantee their majority status in the chambers of the legislature for a decade.
So how and when did redistricting become so political?
Well, it really begins in 1962, the redistricting revolution, because before that, the courts wouldn't touch the whole issue of redistricting. So states rarely redrew their districts. They redrew congressional districts only if they gained or lost a seat. And in terms of state legislative chambers, they maybe didn't touch those at all. Well, now, after each census, you have to adjust the populations. The word is one person, one vote. Mm-hmm. And so because the population shifts, you have to make adjustments.
Right. So without getting too far into the weeds, can you bring us through the process for drawing Georgia's voting districts?
Well, we will get the census data probably the last week of 2020. And to that will then be married political data. Now, the Census Bureau doesn't collect that. So the smallest unit the Census Bureau uses is called a census block.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the smallest political unit is a precinct, which is made up of many census blocks. So for probably the next 6, 7, 8 months, there'll be work going on at the Legislative Reapportionment Office, and that's been in business now for about 40 years. And they'll merge the political data and the population data together, and that's what will then be used when the governor calls a special session, probably August, maybe September of 2021, and they'll sit down to draw these new maps.
Well, let me go through what's happened so far in Georgia to better understand this. Normally, districts only get redrawn once every 10 years or so, which is what you're describing. So why were districts redrawn back in 2015?
Okay, well, I said usually those are set in place. Now, there virtually every legislative session, there'll be some minor adjustments. Sometimes it's because a legislator wants to move to a new house which is nearby but not quite in the district the legislator's represented, so they'll loop that in. Sometimes it'll be to make it easier for election officials. But the adjustments that were made in 2015 appear to have been done to help prop up two Republicans whose districts were undergoing demographic changes, which made them much more competitive.
So there are no parameters at all on that kind of thing? There's no other oversight other than we just wanted to include these two houses?
That's exactly right, yeah. I mean, clearly, you know, someone or a group could challenge it in court, but otherwise, no, especially now that we're not longer subject to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Now, prior to 2013, any kind of adjustment like this would have to have gotten approval either by the Department of Justice or by the District Court of the District of Columbia.
So let's go through that. Earlier this year, a federal district court found compelling evidence that in 2015, state lawmakers redrew districts along racial lines to protect the General Assembly's Republican majority. Those state legislators who redrew the maps, however, said it was party, not race, that was the basis for these new districts. Can you go a little bit further in that ruling and that defense?
Yeah, that defense goes back to a Supreme Court decision for 2000. And that involved a case out of a congressional district out of North Carolina. And the challenge was that it had been drawn along racial lines, and the state said, oh, no, we were just trying to draw a Democratic district. Well, now the court did acknowledge that, at least in the South, a heavily Democratic district is probably one that also has a high concentration of African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But for the last, now, about 18 years or so, if you can convince a court that, oh, no, we turned off, and again, literally you turn off a thing on your computer so it doesn't show this, turn off the race data and turn on the partisan data, courts have generally let that go. Now, there were also three cases before the Supreme Court during this last term which did try to get at whether partisan gerrymandering might be something that courts would strike down. Supreme Court did not bite on those. There's a North Carolina case, which will have another hearing probably in this current session. But right now, you can pretty much do whatever you want to as long as your explanation is we were trying to take care of our party and disadvantage the other party.
So, first, why is partisanship an acceptable justification and not race?
Okay, well, race is a suspect category, and any time in any kind of context in which you're separating people on the basis of race, you have to come up with an extraordinarily compelling reason to do so. But courts look at party, and indeed, although courts will now at least hear cases involving charges of partisan gerrymandering, prior to 1986, if you came in and said the other party took advantage of our party, courts would say, well, you'd have done the same thing, so get out of here. You didn't even have standing to go to court. For the last 30, 32 years, courts have at least said, okay, we'll hear the case. But so far, no Supreme Court case has ever found an instance in which the partisan gerrymandering was so bad that the court threw out the districts.
In fact, some people do say, well, if lawmakers can't do this fairly, let an impartial third party like the courts, as you alluded to, or computer algorithms, that's another proposal, decide. But when this gerrymandering case came before the Supreme Court earlier this year, Chief Justice John Roberts backed away from that model. Let's hear him.
If you're the intelligent man on the street and the court issues a decision and let's say, oh, the Democrats win, the intelligent man on the street is going to say it must be because the Supreme Court preferred the Democrats over the Republicans. And that's going to come out one case after another as these cases are brought in every state. And that is going to cause very serious harm to the status and integrity of the decisions of this court in the eyes of the country.
So avoiding the political thicket, as the saying goes, in the Supreme Court history. But what does that actually mean? Do you think that people came away thinking, oh, okay, then it is a fair process, rather than the Supreme Court is on one side or the other?
I suspect most people at least think about this, probably have some suspicions that one side or the other has its thumb on the scale when it comes to drawing districts.
But we should make clear that Republicans in the case of, for example, in Georgia, but not the only party that's been accused of gerrymandering, Democrats redistricted Georgia to their advantage in the early 2000s. So can you take us back to that time? What did Democrats do to preserve their own power?
Well, those are some of the most extraordinary maps that you'd ever see. And the reason was because Democrats knew that unless they took extraordinary actions, almost any other kind of plan would result in a Republican majority in both the House and Senate. So Democrats were desperate to maintain the majorities that they had had for well over a century. And so they packed Republicans, i.e., put extra Republicans into districts to kind of soak up their majority, and then they tried to stretch out the Democratic minority by having underpopulated districts there. And the three-judge federal panel in Atlanta struck that down because it was seeking to advantage one part of the state as opposed to other parts of the state.
You said it looked extraordinary. Is that like, you know, we've seen these crazy, you know, I've seen these kind of like art doodles based on gerrymandering. It just completely, you know, one side juts out into one direction. It's a pretty complicated process, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah, and part of it is driven by the need to equalize out populations. And so when you're drawing congressional districts, not state legislative districts, but congressional districts, you really need to zero out the population differences. So you literally are going along the edges of a district, you know, adding a few people, subtracting a few people. And then another thing which also drives it, and sometimes has resulted in strange shapes, is the need to draw districts which are likely to give minorities opportunity to elect their candidates of choice. Now, sometimes, like the 5th District in Atlanta, that's not a problem because there's such a large concentration of African Americans. But when they initially drew the 13th District, the one which is represented by David Scott, were trying to make it so it would probably elect an African American, they end up with a district that had the shape that looked like a dead cat on the expressway is what it got known as. It looked like a cat that had been kind of flattened out on the expressway and driven over many times.
That's a terrible image. But is it, you know, how would you see it? If you considered how districts should look if they weren't gerrymandered, what would they look like?
Well, you know, the perfect geometric shape, you know, is a circle, but you couldn't have a state with a whole series of circle districts. So to some extent, you probably do want to take in natural boundaries, a mountain range, a river, or something like this. But you're going to end up with some strange shapes simply as you go about trying to have, let's say, districts that represent communities of interest, which are not necessarily following nice compact lines. But you could certainly come up with maps which don't have some of the extraordinary shapes we've seen historically in Georgia.
Georgia's next governor will play a key role in redistricting Georgia's political boundaries. And my guest, political science Charles Bullock, calls redistricting the most political activity in America. Charles, give us a lay of the land, though. Where do Georgia's congressional and state legislature districts stand now? I mean, do current districts obviously favor one party or the other?
Yeah, very much so. 10 of our 14 congressional districts are represented by Republicans. And over 60% of our state House and state Senate districts have Republicans. Now, it's probably unrealistic to think that we should have proportional representation. Our system is not designed for that, like the European systems are. So almost any plan, no matter how fair, is probably going to give an advantage, almost certainly will give an advantage to the majority party, whichever one it is. Undoubtedly, if Democrats had drawn the maps, say, in 2011, they'd do somewhat better, unless they, again, went through extraordinary measures, and I'm not sure they could even do it, would not have been able to draw a majority for themselves. Mm-hmm. So
let's play this out. If Stacey Abrams wins, what would she and Democrats be able to accomplish in terms of redistricting, given that the General Assembly will likely maintain a Republican majority?
Yeah, it's almost certain it will. So what a Democratic governor could do is it would give Democrats a seat at the table. So the legislature would draw districts. They would then present them to the governor because a redistricting plan is simply a piece of legislation. And like other pieces of legislation, the governor can exercise a veto. So having a Democratic governor would mean that the maps would be less favorable to Republicans. I suspect Republicans would probably still come out with a majority in each chamber, but there would be some need to build in some additional Democratic districts as opposed to if Republicans had complete control. Now, of course, one thing might happen is the governor might veto a plan. There might be a deadlock between the governor and the legislature, in which case then it gets kicked to the courts.
Right. So theoretically, one way to remove partisan politics from the equation is to send it to the courts. But play this out for me. If Brian Kemp becomes governor, how would you anticipate districts changing in 2021?
Well, there would be then an effort made by Republicans to ensure that they have a set of maps that would guarantee their majority until the 2032 election. So there would, at the margins, be some additional Republican districts that would be drawn as opposed to a situation in which a Democratic governor could say, no, you're not going to go that far.
Are lawmakers' efforts to draw districts in their favor any real match for the rapid demographic changes in the state now?
Yes, I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Well,
here.
I'm saying that, you know, if the populations are changing so quickly and growing, and especially if we're becoming a majority-minority state, is there enough, can there be enough effort to redraw things to retain a Republican majority or a Republican's favor?
Yeah, okay, all right. Yeah, so you're looking down the road trying to guess what's going to happen over the next 10 years.
Right.
And so what that— The break, then, that puts on a majority is that you do not want to slice your majorities too thin. You don't want to be drawing districts that you think you can win at 51-52%, which if you do that, you know, you maximize the number of seats you could draw for yourself. So if you get greedy in that sense, then you run the risk that as the population changes, you're going to lose a lot of districts. Yeah, so you try to anticipate and probably draw districts which would be maybe 55-60% in favor of your party, which then gives you a margin of error as populations shift.
So what about the idea that computer algorithms should draw the lines of districts instead of politicians because that way it's more, quote unquote, fair?
Well, what would happen, and there's a political scientist who does this, is you would sit your computer up and say, draw me 100, draw me 1,000 maps. Okay, well, what that would do would give you a normal distribution. So you'd say, all right, given the population in this state and the way it's distributed, you'd expect for there to maybe be an 8-6 or a 9-5 kind of split. But still, legislature at some point is going to have to pick a particular map, because there are going to be, you know, literally an infinite number of ways that you could redraw this state.
Charles, you call it the title of your book about the most political activity in America as redistricting. So how about it, though? Is the toothpaste already out of the tube? If we're already this deeply entrenched in politics, is there any way that reform could change this process?
Well, yeah, a popular reform is to take it out of the hands of the legislature and put it in the hands of a commission. In recent years, California and Arizona have done this. Some other states have it on the ballot this year. Florida had an initiative, in which you talked about that process with your previous guest, which was passed in 2010, in which they didn't take the process away from the legislature, but they instructed the legislature not to give extraordinary emphasis to either party or to incumbency. And there have been several suits which have been brought pursuant to that initiative change in the Constitution, and the plaintiffs have won in those, and as a result, that state has had to go through several iterations of redrawing its districts. Mm. So there are several ways you could put a check on what the legislature can do.
UGA professor, political science professor Charles Bullock, what a great amount of things to think about, and thank you so much for the clarity today.
Thank you.
He's author of Redistricting, the Most Political Activity in America. And we want to know if the district lines have changed in around your house in recent years. Let us know. We're on Facebook and on Twitter. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow is Election Day. Newsflash. We're going to hear from a group of first-time voters, and we're going to explore the psychology of winning and losing. And we would love to hear from you. Do you remember your first time voting? What made you want to do it? Or is this your first election, too? Tell us why you are casting a ballot. You can call us. We're at 404-500-9457 or post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on Twitter at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. We spent some time earlier in the program breaking down the proposed state constitutional amendments on the ballot, among them Marcy's Law. This was named for Marcy Nicholas, a California woman who was killed by her ex-boyfriend back in 1983. Georgia now ranks in the top states for deaths from domestic violence. And over the past decade, an average of 126 Georgians are killed each year due to domestic violence. Last year, that number increased by 23 deaths, and that's according to the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Sheena Morris is Policy and Community Engagement Director for the Coalition, and she's with us in the studio. Good morning, Sheena.
Good morning.
LaVon Morris-Grant is also with us. She's founding executive director of Makash Healing Network, and she's also an author. And LaVon, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Sheena, how is domestic violence defined under Georgia law?
So in Georgia, domestic violence is defined in the context of family violence here in Georgia. And so there are relationship qualifiers within that context. So an occurrence that has happened between two spouses, two people that share a or have a child in common, also a step-parent, stepchild. There are a number of relationship qualifiers of how domestic violence is defined in Georgia. What it excludes is dating partners. And so sometimes organizations such as the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence really look at violence, domestic violence, in that broader context of dating violence, partners who may not have a child in common, who may not be spouses, but were certainly in an intimate partner relationship.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe cohabitating.
Right,
awesome.
Right.
So how do advocacy organizations like yours and the one that LaVon works with, how do they define it differently than legal boundaries? You mentioned one of them, but is there more to that?
Right. So as I mentioned, looking at dating partners, looking broadly at the dynamics of violence that are occurring, again, looking at violence in that intimate partner context is how organizations such as GCADV really focuses in on domestic violence.
But how about things like, say, you know, emotional abuse? You don't call the police
right.
for emotional abuse
right.
or, you know, because somebody won't let you go out of the house.
Mm-hmm. So also looking at it much broadly than just the physical violence that is occurring, right? So looking at economic violence that may be occurring, looking at psychological abuse, abuse that is perpetrated by a person using faith against a person who is being victimized, looking at that much broader context.
How about for you, LaVon? Is that something you and your organization, you know, people don't necessarily think, oh, this is domestic abuse, right?
Right. That is so true. And just piggybacking off what Sheena was saying with the emotional and the psychological, the difference with that of how our programs view it, it is domestic violence. The difference is it's just not criminal.
Mm-hmm.
The physical piece of the criminal form or the physical form of domestic violence is the only piece you can report as a crime.
Right.
And even that, sometimes they don't hold the perpetrator accountable to that. The emotional, the psychological, the mental, financial abuse is are tactics of what an abuser will use on top of being physical. And so we help educate women in society to understand the different forms and how they play out in the lives of victims.
Right. So what, Sheena, would you say, as a coalition that put together these numbers, contributed to the increase in domestic violence-related deaths in 2017?
Well, what you're referencing comes directly from the Georgia Domestic Violence Fatality Review report. And what occurred during that reporting period was there were a number of familicides that actually occurred. So domestic violence that was perpetrated directly against a victim, but also other people being victimized in that situation, such as neighbors, children. These people were also a part of the violence that was captured in that report.
So it's systemic in some way.
So it's a larger public safety issue
right.
overall, because you can see that there is an impact that reaches beyond just the direct victim, but there are also other individuals who may be a part of that person's life or community that are also impacted by the violence.
Domestic violence, of course, not just a woman's issue. Men can also be victims, but 85% of victims are women. This is the U.S. Bureau of Justice figures. The risk of domestic violence, however, is even higher for African-American women. Why is that?
So there are a number of factors that go into, the risk being greater. There are systemic issues. There are cultural dynamics that may keep people from reporting. In Georgia, the African-American population makes up about 30%. However, Black and African-American women are dying due to domestic violence at a rate that is twice that of the population. And so, again, looking at those things that are systemic, such as cultural loyalty and how that impacts one's desire to report if they are being victimized. Looking at labeling and stigma that is associated with the issue of domestic violence, taking into context historical trauma of the community. So thinking about things like that when we look at it.
The desire to report, and also why did she stay? Why didn't she leave him? LaVon, we know this is often a line of questioning that people ask and pass judgments on. What is wrong with that line of questioning?
The big problem with that question, first of all, it's a very blaming question when you ask her why doesn't she just leave. And one of the things we've learned at my organization, at Makash Healing Network, over the years, is we put the question back to those asking by saying, why does he abuse her? Let's ask the question that holds the perpetrator accountable, and let's put the onus back where it belongs, or the responsibility of the violence back where it belongs, opposed to asking the victim to pathologizing the victim to figure out what his line of thought is and why he's behaving that way. And then the other part of the question that makes it difficult, if she leaves, where is she going? Because people have this grandiose thought, or this, they want to think it's a pie in the sky that once she leaves, that everything is great. When we know over 75% of women who leave are in more danger.
Mm.
And many women are being killed.
It's staggering to consider those, and there are a lot of factors contributing, but I want to pick up on what Sheena said. How do you think being a woman of color further complicates those decisions, like the decision to leave?
So speaking from being a Black woman and being a Black woman who was abused, for me and so many of my of women that I've worked with who are women of color, the big piece for a lot of us is the cultural piece and with the distrust of the police and not just the police, but the big distrust of the whole criminal justice system, just how it treats our community in general, not per se one particular incident, but just in general of how racism plays out in our community and the way we see it. Not from the way people see it from the outside, but from the way we see it and feeling like we don't have a voice to speak to those systems to say, hey, this is the way you can work with us. And these are the reasons why we feel the way we feel, opposed to just shutting it down and being defensive and not hearing the point of view of how we see. If I report my intimate partner on abusing me, that you then won't kill him next because that's not what I'm looking for you to do.
Right. Or he enters into the criminal justice system, and we know there's a lot of disparity in how men of color are treated, certainly. That's LaVon Morris-Grant. She and Sheena Morris are with us. We're talking about domestic violence in Georgia, and our state ranks in the top 15 in the nation for domestic violence-related deaths. But LaVon, I want to pick up on that. If you feel comfortable talking about it, you're somebody who helps healing and advocating for survivors of domestic violence, which you are yourself. Can you speak about that? Did you know at the beginning you were experiencing domestic violence?
So, no, to your answer first. I did not know, and people need to know. Most women do not know. I don't care how educated you are. It's not about the education. But for me, it was emotional and verbal. And back then, we weren't even focused on emotional and verbal. And I wasn't even connected to the work back then. Mm-hmm. So I had no idea of language, that domestic violence was a language, that verbal abuse was a issue, that what was what my husband and I was experiencing, that that was something that there was, it was just arguments to me.
So what crosses the line of verbal abuse for you?
So verbal abuse that I was receiving and that a lot of other women, you know, calling me out of my name, just constantly putting me down, undermining, you know, me as a person, as your wife, you know, or, you know, whatever those pieces look like. So when you're going, we're constantly going back and forth. And so even when the advocates told me I was an abused woman, I could not understand how was I abused when he never hit me, because back then we just thought abuse was about physical.
Right.
And growing up, I just thought you could call me all the names you want, as long as you don't hit me, I'm okay. But threats, calling you out of your name, spitting on you, all those things are forms of abuse. So when my husband then shoots me 4 times, 10 months later, that is shocking. For us, for me, the community, his family, everyone. And then when the community and church blames me for his behavior of shooting me 4 times and then shooting himself and dying 2 days later.
Oh, that's a horrible story. And according to the Georgia Domestic Violence Fatality Review Project, firearms were the cause of 70% of those deaths. You clearly survived, thank goodness. But what does Georgia law say about domestic violence and firearms, Sheena?
So currently there is no existing legislation on the Georgia books pertaining to firearms. There is federal legislation which codifies that those who have been convicted of a misdemeanor act of domestic violence cannot possess ammunition or a firearm. However, that law is not codified in Georgia's books.
Well, just a few days ago, a man twice charged with battery against a woman walked into a Tallahassee yoga studio and opened fire. Online, history of racist and misogynist social media posts for him. And what do we know about the perpetrators of mass shootings and the history of domestic violence?
So we very often do know that those who have been involved in mass shooting cases do have a history of domestic violence. There have been several cases in various different states where those individuals were not supposed to be in possession of a firearm and had indeed been convicted of some type of act of family violence.
Yeah, I'm seeing as much as 54%, according to Congressional Research, mass shooters and connected to domestic violence. And so obviously there are a lot of warning signs here for beyond just inside of a woman's safety. Anything that you are advocating from your organizational point of view for the courts, for the law to change, to keep in mind?
Absolutely. Well, we are currently and have for the past 2 years now been advocating for the codification of the federal statute so that it is clear in Georgia statute that, you know, those who have been convicted of an act of family violence or who are subject to a temporary protective order are unable to possess that firearm or any ammunition associated with it. So we are working very hard to implement and to get into law that statute here.
Well, so obviously that's when it gets to an extreme degree. But now here in Georgia, we have, you know, during Breast Cancer Awareness Month in October, everyone wears pink. You know, it's also Domestic Violence Awareness Month in October. People, you don't see them wearing purple for domestic violence awareness. What do you think, LaVon? What kind of stigma surrounds domestic violence? You talked about, you know, how your church didn't support you. What keeps people from supporting and even talking about it?
So when you do the comparison of supporting Breast Cancer Awareness Month with the same month that domestic violence is in, and actually they asked us, could they share that month with us? And we said yes, and they have blown up to where they have. You have to look at when, as a woman or a person, you get a disease, something happened to you that was outside of your control. Mm. Whereas with domestic violence, society looks at it from a blaming angle that she could have done something, she could do this, she could have taken steps, she could have left, she could have called the police, she could have cooked his dinner better, she could have been more submissive. So it's always what she could have done to prevent this the abuse that is happening to her, opposed to a cancer being a disease that you did not ask for and it was outside of your control. So that's the way we look at those two issues, with the shame and embarrassment that is attached to the stigma.
Right. And you were able to get beyond it. You didn't even know, if you continue that metaphor, that you had cancer, you know, initially. What made you take that step forward?
So for me, one, I think for me, it worked out really well in my favor, which I'm so thankful to be alive today, because I still live with a bullet in my head and one in my foot. And my three children witnessed the shooting. Ugh. And we did extensive therapy. And my trust and faith in God, regardless of the church, I still remained it steadfast in my faith in God, because the church is not, God is not the church. And so my relationship to that, and the idea as a mom that three people are dependent on me, three people who had nothing to do with what their dad and I did, really forced me to change a lot of my cultural behaviors and move outside the box and bring in more healthy reasons or more healthy living for my children and I, from an emotional and mental standpoint, so that those three people would have a better chance at their lives, and me breaking that cycle of the thought process of how you respond to issues, and also breaking the cycle of you don't have to abuse anyone in your space because you don't like the way they interact with you.
Well, LaVon, thank you so much for telling your story. So glad you lived to see the day. Thank you. And also Sheena Morris, she's Policy and Community Engagement Director at the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
If you or someone you know needs help, or if you think you're questioning whether you're a victim or of domestic violence, you can connect with an advocate and other services calling the 24-hour statewide domestic violence hotline. That's at 1-800-334-2. Thanks so much for being with us today. We will be back, of course, for Election Day here on Second Thought.